Couldn't face it right now. If you asked me to leave, I get I wasn't your first choice, but I know you're the one for me. Now it's the middle of the night.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Have you gotten your flu shot? It's never too late to protect yourself, your family, and your community against the flu. This year, it is more important than ever. Black and African Americans, people of color, pregnant people, people without health insurance or a regular health care provider, people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease, and people 65 and older are encouraged to get a flu shot. Multnomah County Health Department and Portland Community College are hosting a free weekly drive-through flu vaccine and COVID-19 testing clinic that will be held every Wednesday from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. until March 31, 2021, at PCC's Cascade Campus, Parking Lot 1, located at 701 North Jessup Street in Portland. Entrance is on North Albina Street. You can drive through, bike through, or walk up to. To reserve an appointment for a flu shot or COVID test, call 503-988-8939. That's 503-988-8939. This campaign is a project of the Racial and Ethnic Approaches to Community Health and the Communicable Disease Services programs. It is made possible with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Public Service Announcements.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, House representatives on Wednesday voted 220 to 211 to pass the COVID relief bill known as the American Rescue Plan. The Senate had passed the $1.9 trillion bill on Saturday. House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer had told his colleagues during the debate, quote, "I expect zero Republicans to vote for this bill." A good prediction, given that no Senate Republicans voted for it. 7 weeks into his presidency, Joe Biden is expected to sign the landmark bill into law. A Pew Research poll found that a whopping 70% of Americans say they are in favor of it, and only a third feel that it is too big. One quarter say it doesn't go far enough. The poll also found that a majority of Americans feel Biden made a good faith effort to try to include Republicans. Another CNN poll released on the same day found similar public support for the American Rescue Plan, with a majority backing various aspects of the bill that pour money into needed programs like schools, child tax credits, and stimulus checks. In other news, the House on Tuesday passed a sweeping pro-union bill to reform labor laws called the Protecting the Right to Organize, or PRO Act. It was the second time the House passed the bill, having first voted on it a year ago, but the bill languished in the Republican-controlled Senate. Now, as a critically important union vote at an Amazon warehouse in Alabama is taking place, the PRO bill enables, among other things, contract workers to have the right to join unions. It also undermines state-level so-called right-to-work laws that Republicans have used to try to decimate unions. Five Republicans voted for the PRO Act alongside yes votes from all but one Democrat. President Biden tweeted his support for the bill, saying, quote, I believe every worker deserves a free and fair choice to join a union, and the PRO Act will bring us closer to that reality. I urge Congress to send it to my desk so we can summon a new wave of worker power and create an economy that works for everyone. In news from the coronavirus pandemic, which is now officially a year old, Biden says he plans to secure an additional 100 million doses of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine. According to the New York Times, officials said that they expected the doses to be delivered sometime in the second half of this year. The good news is that scientists are optimistic about how well vaccines are working so far. One immunologist, Jeremy Kamel, told NBC News, "This virus is not invincible, and despite all these variants, the vaccines are working great." He added, "There are certain variants that are more transmissible, and we have strong data on that, but the thing people should take away from the variant story is just don't let your guard down." He was referring to several states relaxing their quarantine rules before most Americans have been vaccinated. The slow rollout of the vaccines are partially a result of high demand with low supplies, as well as the complicated tiered system of delivery that many states are relying on in order to ensure equity and access. Still, Black and Latino residents lag behind whites in getting vaccinated. Now, the state of Alaska is trying a different approach, offering the vaccine to anyone 16 years or older. So far, the state has the highest vaccination rate in the nation at 16%. The U.S. Senate on Wednesday voted 66-34 to confirm Marsha Fudge to lead the Department of Housing and Urban Development, making Fudge the first Black woman in more than 40 years in that position. Fudge is a Democratic House representative from Ohio and has promised to address race-based inequities in housing. Meanwhile, Lina Khan, a prominent critic of big tech companies, is set to be nominated to the Federal Trade Commission by President Biden. Khan was part of the team that led a massive antitrust investigation into tech companies' antitrust violations for the House Judiciary Committee last year. In other news, Mr. Biden's nominees for various top Justice Department posts faced Senate hearings this week, where they vowed to restore nonpartisanship to a department devastated by the Trump administration. And a growing number of Democratic lawmakers and progressive advocates are imploring Biden to replace the two top Trump-appointed officials at the Social Security Administration who have an anti-Social Security agenda. Republican senators are backing oil and gas interests and working hard to delay the appointment of Deb Haaland as head of the Interior Department. Steve Daines of Montana and Cynthia Lummis of Wyoming have placed holds on Haaland's confirmation process, calling her a radical threat to Montana's fossil fuel economy and way of life. Haaland, a House representative from New Mexico, would be the nation's first Native American Interior Secretary and has come under fire for her activism in opposing oil and gas projects. Separately, Congresswoman Katie Porter of California challenged an oil and gas representative at a House hearing on Tuesday when he claimed that his industry does not get special tax preferences.
There seems to be a misconception out there that you're operating from, that somehow the oil and gas industry benefits from some special sort of tax structure. We don't. We actually.
Reclaiming my time, Mr. Murphy.
Industry drive.
I will follow up with you, Mr. Murphy, but you do benefit from special rules. There's a special tax rule for intangible drilling costs that does not apply to other kinds of expenses that businesses have. You get to deduct 70% of your costs immediately, and other businesses have to amortize their expenses over their entire profit stream.
Please don't
patronize me by telling me that the oil and gas industry doesn't have any special tax provisions. Because if you would like that to be the rule, I would be happy to have Congress deliver. I yield back.
That's Congresswoman Katie Porter challenging an oil and gas representative on his lies that his industry gets no special tax preferences. The trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd continues its jury selection process in Minneapolis as attorneys grilled prospective jurors about their opinions on the case. AP reports that one woman was dismissed from serving after she, quote, didn't understand why Chauvin didn't get up when Floyd, in a widely seen bystander video that showed Chauvin with his knee pressed on Floyd's neck, kept saying he couldn't breathe. She told attorneys, "That's not fair because we are humans, you know." Another juror said she wasn't sure that she could be impartial.
I definitely fall into the bucket of strong opinions.
Okay, I noticed that on your question.
Yeah.
There were some.
I definitely have strong opinions about the case. I think I could try to be impartial. I don't know that I can promise impartiality.
Another high-profile trial of white teenager Kyle Rittenhouse for the shooting deaths of Black Lives Matter activists has been postponed for 7 months. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has approved an extension for 2,200 National Guard troops to remain in Washington, D.C. through late May. Capitol Police requested the extension ahead of a Friday deadline for troops to leave. The high security remains in place due to ongoing threats facing the Capitol after the January 6th pro-Trump riot. Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump is apparently engaged in a tussle with the GOP over the reins of party fundraising. Trump wants donations to go to his own super PAC and not the traditional groups that finance Republican campaigns. Symbolizing the dangers of trying to support Trump while criticizing him, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell faces a bipartisan backlash for trying to have it both ways. A new poll found that Democrats and Republicans uniformly dislike McConnell, and his unpopularity is now at 57%. And that does it for our news headlines. We'll be back with the rest of the show after this break. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the one-year anniversary of the coronavirus pandemic this week marks a grim tally of deaths in the U.S. and internationally, it seems hard to imagine that there is an end in sight. But several promising vaccines with high efficacy rates offer a glimpse of ending the pandemic. So far, about 300 million vaccine doses have been dispensed in more than 100 countries. But demand is far higher than supply. In the US, which is among the hardest hit nations and which has the highest death toll internationally, the vaccination rate has jumped, and President Joe Biden has taken steps to force pharmaceutical companies to deliver vaccines faster. But has he gone far enough? Several international human rights organizations, including Amnesty International and Oxfam, are demanding what they call a people's vaccine. My guest is Joanne Lin. She directs the Amnesty International USA Advocacy and Government Affairs Department. Welcome to the program, Joanne.
Lovely to be with you, Sonali. Thank you.
So first, let's talk about the United States and the links between how the vaccine was developed and the money, because that's a big part of the conversation. Is it fair to say that companies like Moderna, especially BioNTech, AstraZeneca, received tax dollars to develop their vaccines, their COVID-19 vaccines, in this expedited time frame, that they didn't just reach into their own stockpiles of money and risk their own money, they got tax dollars to do it?
Yes. So, Sonali, you're correct. In 2020, the Trump administration provided billions of dollars in upfront payments, clinical trial support, and guaranteed purchase so that U.S. pharmaceutical companies producing these critical COVID products would not have to bear the entire risk.
So now these companies, BioNTech, Pfizer, although BioNTech, I believe, is a German company, but Pfizer, Moderna, Johnson & Johnson, have the patents. They own the patents to the vaccines that were funded by tax dollars. They're being paid for those vaccines that they develop. Is the reason why supplies of vaccines are still so limited because They're holding on to vaccine patents, or is there another reason for the slowness of producing vaccines?
Well, I think there are multiple reasons. I mean, obviously the demand far exceeds the supply. Then a major contributing factor is that the wealthy nations of the world, including the United States, Canada, EU, Israel, have been buying many times the supply necessary. Like in the United States, our government has purchased enough vaccine doses to immunize our entire populace three times over. So while this type of vaccine hoarding is taking place, you have other countries, primarily in the global south, lower income countries, that have not been able to compete on this world market and do not have not been able to purchase these vaccine doses. So it's a situation where we have the global north, which is overwhelmingly the United States, Canada, Japan, and EU, countries that also happen to be home to the major drug pharmaceutical companies. They have adequate vaccine supply, but then the lower income countries in the global south do not have adequate supply and are likely going to have to wait multiple years before they receive vaccines to immunize their population.
Now, for an American who's waiting to get vaccinated, how do you respond to this notion that from their perspective, even the US doesn't have adequate vaccine supplies?
So I understand the concerns. We all have, you know, family members, neighbors, colleagues who are anxiously waiting the supply and waiting their turn to get vaccinated. And the president has announced a plan that if all proceeds as planned, the entire American population should be vaccinated by this summer, with priority given to those most at risk, whether by age or pre-existing health condition or other external factors. So that's proceeding as planned. But even if you look at this strictly from the perspective of the United States, we have seen virus variations emerge from the UK and from South Africa. And as these variants emerge, they will continue to pose health risks to Americans. So even if we adopted this approach of America first or America only, that is not going to keep us safe in the long run.
Right, unless you close all international borders, no country can really keep itself safe if there are other countries where the vaccination effort is going to be delayed by years.
That's correct. If there's one thing this pandemic has taught us, it's that a global pandemic demands a global solution, which in turn requires global coordination and global solidarity.
Another sort of devil's advocate approach: if other countries got access to patents and the information, the recipes, if you will, for the vaccines, that doesn't have to impact vaccine supplies to the U.S., right? Associated Press, about a couple of weeks ago, did an investigation saying that they found factories on three continents whose owners say they could start producing hundreds of millions of COVID vaccines on short notice if only they had the blueprints and technical know-how. It's not as though all countries have to rely on this handful of pharmaceutical companies to make the vaccines and have access to them. If those companies shared the know-how, you could have other companies produce the same vaccines for other countries, right?
So Nali, you've nailed the issue, and this is the issue that's actually before the World Trade Organization, the TRIPS Council this very week. So there is a waiver that has been proposed by the governments of India and South Africa since October, which is widely supported by much of the developing world. And this waiver would be a temporary waiver that would waive the global intellectual property rights. And the reason that approving that waiver and agreeing to that waiver is critical is because of what you just exactly outlined, that there are manufacturers in other parts of the world that do not have access to the know-how and the patents for this COVID vaccine. But if they were given access to that, if US and other drug makers shared that information, there are companies in other parts of the world that could start boosting the vaccine supply and producing the vaccines necessary to immunize their population. So the issue before the WTO, the World Trade Organization, is whether the United States, the European Union, and the wealthy nations of the world are going to agree to this waiver. And presently, the wealthy nations of the world have opposed the waiver and are safeguarding the pharmaceutical companies' intellectual property rights over providing equitable, just distribution of the vaccine to all peoples across the world.
What do the pharmaceutical companies that have developed this vaccine using tax dollars, what would they lose by sharing the vaccine know-how? Do they think that they would lose the business of, you know, being able to sell vaccines to, say, South Africa, that, you know, if another company started doing it and getting paid to deliver vaccines? Are they, is it just about profits? You know, because of course they can't produce all the vaccines needed all at once. So right now they are a bottleneck. Are they holding on to these vaccine patents because they worry about future profits they might miss out on?
I can't speak for the pharmaceutical industry, but I will say that to date, they have largely chosen not to engage with the World Health Organization. They've cited concerns that global initiatives would undermine their intellectual property rights and would disincentivize innovation. If you look at the three US-based drug manufacturers with approved COVID vaccines, Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson, none of these companies has committed to licensing their intellectual property to the World Health Organization for worldwide use, and nor have they facilitated technology transfers to other drug manufacturers. So Amnesty International is calling on the Biden administration to support these World Health Organization platforms and to place conditions on public funding for COVID products to ensure that pharmaceutical companies will share their innovations through these WHO platforms.
So let's talk about the campaign for a people's vaccine. Your organization, Amnesty International, is involved, so is Oxfam. Tell me about this initiative. I understand there's a petition as well that's part of it. I mean, what is this initiative calling for, and who is the, you know, power holder, if you will? There's, of course, the World Trade Organization, but I imagine there's also the governments of the countries that the pharmaceutical companies are based in, like the United States.
Absolutely. So, Sonali, the People's Vaccine Alliance formed last year, and the name is a self-descriptor. The purpose of the alliance, which includes Amnesty, Global Justice Now, Oxfam, Public Citizen, and several hundred other organizations around the world, has formed together to ensure that a COVID-19 vaccine is made available to all peoples around the world, with a special eye towards people in the global south, countries with lower incomes. You know, the ability to gain access to the COVID vaccine should not depend on the country you live in or how much money you earn. But practically speaking, that's what we're looking at in 2021. So the number one priority for the People's Vaccine Alliance is to get the World Trade Organization members to agree to this intellectual property waiver. And right now, it's a handful of countries that are standing in the way of that waiver being approved. It's the United States, the European Union, the UK, Japan, Canada. These are the wealthy nations of the world that have the resources to directly purchase sufficient vaccines to immunize their population several times over. And by the same token, these countries have an extra burden and responsibility to ensure that the vaccine is made available to all countries of the world.
It costs to do that, it doesn't cost the lives of the people or access to vaccines of the people in those rich countries. It simply costs the potential future profits of those pharmaceutical companies, who really don't deserve, and I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say, don't deserve those profits, because they didn't spend the money, they didn't risk their own money to develop the vaccines in the first place. This is an issue of life and death. These aren't, you know, optional medications that just improve one's quality of life. It's about life and death. And they didn't have to risk any of their money, but it seems as though the US and other governments are protecting the future profits of these countries in a way that doesn't even have to do with protecting the safety of, say, Americans.
Absolutely. And if we were just talking very narrowly about the safety of Americans, it is in Americans' interest to make sure that the rest of the world is immunized in all places as quickly as possible. That is one of, this is one of these times where the global priority and Americans' priorities line up completely. So, you know, we are urging the Biden administration to continue supporting the World Health Organization. The Biden administration has undertaken a number of different initiatives that are most welcomed by Amnesty, including pledging $4 billion to the World Health Organization's COVAX pillar. This is a critical initiative that the Trump administration had declined to engage in. But the real issue that is before the Biden administration today, this week, is whether or not they will continue to block this intellectual property waiver under consideration at the World Trade Organization. The World Trade Organization members tend to operate by consensus. So if the United States continues to oppose the waiver, the World Trade Organization is not going to approve the waiver. And we cannot afford to dilly-dally. As you've said, a couple months, that's going to result in many more lives lost. And we have, the world has already, you know, paid an incredible cost and toll due to this pandemic over the past year.
And it's very likely that most of the United States' population will be vaccinated by the end of this year. But in other countries, we're looking at several years. What about the fact that there are other vaccines that have been developed? India has its vaccine developed by, I believe, a company called Bharat Biotech called the Covaxin. And then China's vaccine, Sinopharm or Sinovac, by its company. You know, these vaccines have not yet finished, I understand, all of their third stage clinical trials yet, but I think India's vaccine has shown to be at least 81% effective in clinical trials. Is it possible for these large countries in the global south who have had the capacity to develop vaccines to share their vaccine know-how?
You know, I don't know. I can't speak to other countries in terms of, you know, where they are in their vaccine supply. India is the leader, along with South Africa, for this intellectual property at the World Trade Organization. So clearly the Indian government sees that based on its current vaccine manufacturing supply, that it's not going to be sufficient for their population. This is a time when the world cannot afford to do plan A, and then if that fails, plan B, and right. If that fails, go to plan C. We have to be full steam ahead, full throttle on all initiatives. And so that's why the World Trade Organization intellectual property waiver has to be lifted so that the know-how, the technology, the patents can be shared with drug manufacturers around the world so that they can start to manufacture their own supply and to get those shots into the arms of the people throughout.
Now,
the
in a piece that you just wrote, you point out that of the three companies whose COVID-19 vaccines have been authorized for emergency use in the United States, only Moderna has made a commitment to forego enforcing its patents against those producing vaccines to combat the pandemic. Tell me about that. And is that an opening that even without necessarily going through the World Trade Organization, that countries where there is the ability, you know, where there are factories capable of producing these vaccines could take the Moderna know-how?
I mean, certainly it's a bright development on the part of Moderna. And we would urge the Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson to follow suit. I think the question remains like whether or not that's going to be adequate to meet the need.
Just one company, you need all the three major companies to share the know-how, you're saying?
Exactly.
And of course, I'm wondering if the fact that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine that has been approved for emergency authorization here in the United States is one that's most attractive, considering that it doesn't require the special refrigeration that the other two mRNA vaccines require, and that it's a one-dose vaccine, making distribution so much easier. This one vaccine in particular seems like it is much more within the grasp of a country, you know, that sees several-year wait time for vaccination.
Yes, I mean, you know, I think all eyes have been on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine for a long time, even here in the United States, exactly for the reasons that you mentioned. And, you know, in the Global South, there are additional impediments that create issues in terms of vaccine distribution. As you mentioned, the extremely cold temperatures required for some of the vaccines, the transportation, the disbursement logistics involved. So, you know, Amnesty International is urging all three companies, all U.S.-based drug manufacturers, to follow the example set by Moderna.
If the three companies do temporarily suspend their patents, what would be the next step? How fast could countries in the global south that are really struggling, how fast could they have vaccines be mobilized? Because the situation is extremely dire. I mean, I'm looking at Brazil in particular, which is one of the hardest hit nations in the world.
So, one thing to clarify, even if the three U.S. drug manufacturers were to lift, their restrictions, that would not suffice because the intellectual property system is very complicated. There are U.S. domestic laws, there are international intellectual property laws, which is why the World Trade Organization waiver is so critical.
So it's
absolutely essential that the WTO waiver be approved so that that block can be lifted and so that manufacturers can proceed with developing and manufacturing the vaccines as needed.
Has there been any indication that you can tell from the Biden administration toward, objecting to this WTO waiver request? I mean, we know that Biden sees the importance in a disaster to take the right step. Here in the United States, he has invoked the Defense Production Act to force Merck to produce the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and force Johnson & Johnson to share its know-how with Merck. So, this was a step that the Trump administration wasn't willing to take. So Biden clearly knows that in a dire situation, it is important for governments to step in. I'm wondering if you think that there is any willingness or openness on the World Trade Organization front that you might be seeing from the Biden administration.
The Biden administration has been silent on this issue thus far. So, although Biden has only been in office for, about
less than
almost
2 months,
his administration has continued the position of the Trump administration, which was to oppose the waiver. That's why this week at the World Trade Organization, it's such a critical time, because many advocates in the People's Vaccine Alliance and elsewhere are looking to see if there's going to be a change in the U.S. position. Amnesty International has been lobbying European governments intensively, as well as the U.S. and Canada, to reverse course. But clearly, the U.S. is the leader here. And so other countries are going to be closely watching to see what the Biden administration elects to do. Thus far, we have not heard anything from the Biden administration to indicate a change in their position.
And I'm wondering if part of it is just that there isn't that much news coverage here in the United States and enough public awareness of the international perspective on the vaccine and vaccine access. I mean, Americans are overwhelmed with what we are experiencing ourselves. And at the same time, as you've said several times now, what happens outside our borders does affect us, because the longer the virus circulates in other countries, the more dangerous variants can develop. And eventually those variants, whether we like it or not, will come to the United States. Is there a petition or anything, any way for Americans to pressure the Biden administration to take this people's vaccine approach to the World Trade Organization and take it seriously?
Yes, absolutely. And Amnesty International has a petition on our website. I would invite you to go to www.amnesty.org, where you can learn about how to take action to urge the Biden administration and other wealthy nations of the world to approve the proposed intellectual property waiver under consideration at the World Trade Organization. And share this with your friends and neighbors and colleagues in other countries as well, because this is a global imperative that has to be addressed both here at home as well as around the world.
Well, we'll certainly post a link to that from our website as well. Well, Joanna, I want to thank you so much for joining us. I understand that there's also a peoplesvaccine.org website where people can learn more about this idea, and there's a video that they can share.
Absolutely. That's a great resource as well. And, you know, this is an issue that we are constantly learning about, right? I mean, all of us are learning about the COVID virus, the COVID vaccine in real time. And we encourage everyone to educate yourself. We understand how people are overwhelmed here because the U.S. has been so hard hit. But what's different between what's happening here versus the rest of the world is that we are beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel. And for other parts of the world, there is no light at the end of the tunnel. And there won't be if the present situation continues. So it is very much before us, and it is doable, and it is attainable for the Biden administration, the U.S., to help lead the way to ensure that the COVID vaccines that are going to keep us safe here at home can also get into the arms of all people around the world.
Joanna, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Again, that website is peoplesvaccine.org. Thanks so much, Joanne.
Thank you, Sonali. Wonderful to be with you.
My guest has been Joanne Lynn. She directs Amnesty International USA's Advocacy and Government Affairs Department. And we've been discussing the idea of a people's vaccine and a vote in the World Trade Organization this week around suspending vaccine patents. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify. From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the United States transitions to a new presidency, attempting to put 4 years of Donald Trump behind us, Mr. Joe Biden has a flurry of initial actions planned, including rejoining the Paris Accords and putting an end to the Keystone XL pipeline project. But according to my next guest, climate action needs to be rooted in local actions and policy, and most importantly, in justice. Shalanda Baker is a professor at the Northeastern School of Law. Before joining Northeastern's faculty, she spent 3 years as an associate professor of law at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii, where she was the founding director of the Energy Justice Program. In 2016, she won a Fulbright Award and spent a year in Mexico exploring energy reform, climate change, and indigenous rights. She now joins me to discuss her new book, Revolutionary Power, An Activist's Guide to the Energy Transition. Welcome to the program, Shalanda.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
So as we are transitioning to a Biden presidency, on the broad federal level, do you see hope on the horizon, especially as compared to the 4 years of Trump when we are talking about climate change and even climate justice?
Sonali, there is no comparison. I mean, we're talking about night and day. So we think about the Trump administration, it was very much a systematic dismantling of environmental protections for communities of color, most notably, you know, waiving requirements for polluters right in the middle of the pandemic, even when we were beginning to learn more about how exposure to air pollution made it more likely that you were going to suffer, bleak consequences as a result of COVID-19. So the Trump administration has taken a very cynical approach to environmental protection and very much driven by profit and driven by sort of, again, rollbacks. The New York Times itself did an analysis and found over 100 different regulatory rollbacks in that administration. And so as we turn the page to the Biden administration, we're already seeing with some of his top picks a very different approach, starting with Michael Regan, the head of the EPA, a Black policymaker from North Carolina, which I should say is where the environmental justice movement really took off, in Warren County. And so, that signals his appointment, and again, it needs to be Senate confirmed, his appointment really signals a shift in terms of how we're thinking about environmental issues. I think similarly, setting up a climate czar, if you will, in Gina McCarthy, and she will be right at the White House driving climate policy. That signals a real attention to climate change as an issue. And Gina obviously comes out of the EPA. She's now going to be the outgoing president of, or president and CEO of the Natural Resources Defense Council. So she really has the technical chops to drive climate policy. She was one of the architects of the Clean Power Plan under the Obama administration. And as her deputy, she has Ali Zaidi, who comes out of New York. New York is a leading state in terms of climate policy. Just last summer, Governor Cuomo signed into law the Community Leadership and Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which really makes a commitment to frontline environmental justice communities. And so I think with this team that also includes John Kerry as an external international climate envoy, we're really set up for success. And I would be remiss without mentioning the Council on Environmental Quality, which is where a lot of the environmental justice work in the administration happens. And we have Brenda Mallory, who is coming from the Southern Environmental Law Center, really driving and leading a lot of initiatives there. And she's a veteran to government work. And one of her key deputies there will be Cecilia Martinez, who I think of as the mother of the environmental justice movement. If that long answer didn't give you any clue, I'll just put a fine point on it. And that is, we're headed in a vastly different direction with this new administration.
You write in your book that your main objective, quote, is to model an approach of justice first in pursuit of averting catastrophic climate change rather than one of climate first, justice later. What do you mean by that? What have you been worried about in seeing the approach to tackling climate change?
Yeah. So, Sonali, I'll answer that question by giving an example and an anecdote from my own background and my own life story. So I left practice as a corporate lawyer way back in 2009 and found myself in 2010 in January living in Oaxaca, Mexico, which is very much ground zero for Mexico's energy transition. And when I say energy transition, I'm talking about the transition away from fossil fuels to clean energy. And so when I got to Oaxaca, I actually met indigenous peoples who were fighting against mega wind, massive wind development. And as I dug into that issue, I realized that they were being dispossessed, displaced, divided, not to use too many D words, but all of the bad things that we connect to fossil fuel and fossil fuel development were happening in Oaxaca. And Oaxaca, again, is a remarkable place for any of your viewers out there. I recommend it. But it's also home to no fewer than 14 distinct indigenous groups. It's one of the poorest places in Mexico. And the place where all of this wind energy development was taking place is called the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. And it's a small stretch of land that happens to be one of the windiest places on Earth. And so starting from my time in 2010 to now, we've seen an exponential growth of wind energy development there and a very much a grassroots indigenous movement against that development because they're simply not benefiting from it. And now Oaxaca has the proud distinction of being a place with one of the highest, if not the highest concentration of onshore wind energy in the world. And again, that type of dense development, extractive development, that is not benefiting them at all. And so I had the opportunity, as you mentioned in lead up and in my bio, that to go down to Mexico in 2016 to serve as a Fulbright scholar. And, you know, I was there to really look at and explore and do research connected to the transition, Mexico's transition. They just opened up their markets to private investments for the first time in over 100 years. And, you know, I had the opportunity to sit down with a policymaker who was at the equivalent of the Department of Energy, but in Mexico. And I said, what are we going to do? You know, how are you going to address these social and environmental issues related to this transition? And you're running over the rights of indigenous peoples in this development. And he said, Shalonda, climate change. We have to do this because climate change is an emergency. And so again, this is a mentality of let's avert climate change first and then worry about issues of equity. But what is lost in that analysis is the understanding that the very people that you're sort of running over in your race to avert catastrophic climate change are the ones who are on the front lines who will receive the very worst impacts of the climate emergency. And so I argue in the book that we should be centering those communities and centering their concerns in this transition.
So are you worried that the same structures and the same institutions that have fomented climate change are going to be handed the reins of getting us out of this crisis and therefore leave out the issue of justice and human rights? I mean, we see even fossil fuel companies and financial institutions, you know, sort of come late to the party and decided that they are now going to work toward addressing climate change, of course, in the hopes of making money from it. But that may be a massive, be fraught with pitfalls.
It is absolutely fraught with pitfalls. And I think we need to be really careful about who we empower in this transition. And I think we need to interrogate the structures that we have come to accept as a natural part of the fabric. And by structures, I mean our approaches to energy policy, our approaches to electricity rate making, as well as our approaches to, you know, the types of actors that we're relying on to shepherd us, you know, out of this dark place with, you know, the heavy reliance on fossil fuels to clean energy. And I, you know, very skeptically view, you know, the fossil fuel industry as it attempts to sort of change hats, you know, in this new moment. So I think you're absolutely right to voice some skepticism on your end and also cynicism even. With respect to the types of actors that we're relying on. And so I would argue that, again, all of it is on the table. We know that we have a legal system that is rife with inequality. We know that there's so much structural inequality all around us. And I would connect the struggle for, you know, racial justice within the criminal justice system to the struggle for racial justice within the energy system. You know, no part of our society has been spared by structural inequality. So it follows that our electricity system and that our energy system are similarly burdened by racial injustice.
Tell me about your time in Port Arthur, Texas, which you write about in your book, and how that is in many ways an example of the environmental racism we have seen and can offer a guide to how climate change needs to focus on justice.
Right. So Port Arthur, Texas is the birthplace of the modern fossil fuel industry, as well as its current spine and epicenter. It's also a low-income Black and Latinx community, and it is a part of what is broadly referred to as the Golden Triangle, which is to say that on a satellite image, you see lights lighting up this particular part of the Texas-Louisiana border area. And it's it, there, that area is lit up because of all the petrochemical and fossil fuel facilities that are concentrated in this particular place. It's also been called Cancer Alley because in many ways, it is what we would call in the environmental justice community a sacrifice zone. So that place has been sacrificed in order to provide cheap energy to the rest of us in this country. It also happens to be the place where my father grew up. And my father worked in the electricity sector for the local utility. My grandfather worked for, I think, Chevron. My uncles also worked for the oil industry. And so it is both the benefactor as well as the thing that has made life for people in that area so difficult from an environmental standpoint. We have cancer rates that are higher there. We have all sorts of other maladies that are high due to their status as an environmental justice community. And so I had the opportunity to spend a little bit of time there when I was around 8 years old. And I took it, my parents were split. So I had a chance to go down with my sister and we spent a summer there. And I really got to know that place. I fell in love with it. It was, you know, for me, such a foreign land. I grew up in Austin, which is very urban, and Port Arthur is semi-rural in some ways, and it's on the bayou, and there's a fishing culture, so people are crabbing and fishing and eating fried fish for dinner, and the accents are different. I mean, I couldn't understand anything going on half the time, but I fell in love with it, and as I pulled back many, many years later, I mean, I'm talking about in the last couple years, and really began to dive into my work on energy justice and environmental justice, I realized that Port Arthur is so crucial to our nation's energy story. And I'll give you one stark example that was very much my entry point into Port Arthur as a study. Back in 2017, I was, you know, fastidiously following all of the news and developments around Hurricane Harvey. And, you know, late one night I was scrolling through the New York Times and there was a Facebook Live video posted and a young man was on the video saying, "Help us, please help us. We are in knee deep water, we need help, we need help." And this was a young man from Port Arthur. And that young man happened to be my half brother. So that was the moment where it hit me that I have a stake in this transition and I have commitments based on where I come from. To tell these stories.
You write that utilities reform is the linchpin to transforming the energy system. And in addition to Mexico, in addition to Port Arthur, Hawaii and the state of Hawaii is a very important model for climate justice, but also, you know, showcasing how that whole struggle unfolded. Tell me about what Hawaii can teach us, you know, for those who were lucky enough to have traveled there. One thing jumps out at people, which is that rooftop solar is almost everywhere on mm-hmm. any of the islands. Many of the islands have you know, homes that are just dotted with solar on their rooftops, which could be the case in many more states around the nation, but isn't. Why?
Right. So, Sonali, I love that you read the book and found it so compelling. It's like, yes, that was the goal, to really make, you know, these technical energy topics come alive, and for the sakes of our transition to really become tangible to the reader. And so I had the privilege and honor to go to Hawaii in 2014, and I joined the faculty at the University of Hawaii School of Law. And I got there at a really exciting time. So as you say, Sonali, rooftop solar was everywhere. And at that time, there was about, I think there were about 17% of all of residents there had rooftop solar. So that's almost one in five. It's extraordinary. It was the highest rate of solar adoption in the country at that time. And so at the same time, the utility was pushing up against that and saying, whoa, 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 this is too much distributed energy generation, because that rooftop solar was taking away from their ability to, their bottom line, essentially. You know, when you generate solar on your rooftop, you're getting a discount. You're selling your electricity back to the grid as opposed to having to pay the provider for your electricity. And this was cutting into the utility's profits. And so they're making a range of arguments, including that the grid was too unstable to allow for so much electricity going back into the grid. The grid was designed to push it out to homes. They were making the argument that rooftop solar hurt poor people because it was leaving them with the cost of maintaining
and,
the grid.
And this is an argument you hear over and over and over again in so many different arenas. You know, here in California, where I am based, you hear any arguments usually pushed by corporate lobbyists that anything that is there to hurt them or their bottom line really is an insult to poor people and working people and people of color.
Well, here's what I would say in response in terms of the insults, right? Rooftop solar isn't the insult. The insult is placing fossil fuel generation in communities of color. Mm. The insult is the disproportionate burden that homes, low to moderate income homes, are paying for electricity. Our electricity rate design is regressive. That means the poorest people are paying more of their overall income to just keep the lights on. That's an insult. That's the issue that utilities should be tackling rather than trying to end rooftop solar, which actually lowers emissions, if we think about it over a longer time horizon, in the very communities they say they care about. You know, that's my response to that. So it's a very sort of cynical, disingenuous approach. And so all of that was kind of happening in Hawaii. It was the preview to what we are seeing around the country. And for me, it was just like a kid in the candy store. What I realized, going back to your original question, is that utilities were at the heart of all of these debates. And they were at the heart of all of those debates because of their business model. They're incentivized to sell electricity. They're incentivized to build infrastructure, to build stuff. And the regulator in the state, and I'm making it sound like a soap opera because it really felt like a soap opera then. Mm-hmm. The regulator in the state, the Public Utilities Commission, said, utility, you are slow walking our clean energy transition. You must innovate or you're gonna be regulated out of existence. So either you can play a role in this transition or you need to step aside because climate change is real and, you know, distributed energy is something that we need for resilience and for a whole host of reasons. And so I got to witness that. And that's why utility justice and utility reform have become such a central part, I think, of my analysis regarding our energy transition and how to do that in a way that is just.
And of course, on the mainland here in the United States, you see, you know, many people who might love to have solar on their rooftops if they're lucky enough to be homeowners or simply be able to draw their energy from solar and not have to live near, say, a fracking well, but simply don't have the money to make that happen because they're busy putting food on their table. So how can the Hawaii model be expanded to local communities, to utilities across the country, because it shouldn't be that cost prohibits people from being able to have rooftop solar.
You're absolutely right, Sonali. So there are three key ways people can get access to solar. They've got the savings and they can buy the solar panels outright. Okay. You know, we know who's privileged enough to do that. And we know kind of how wealth disparities have played out in this country. So that's not a lot of Black and Brown and Indigenous people. The second way is, you know, you can go to the bank and get a loan to have them buy the solar panels and you pay off that loan.
Or there are companies that just lease it to you, which is what I did for my...
That's the third way.
Oh, I see.
The third, yeah. So the third way is the leasing model. And I think all of those ways or of accessing solar are kind of put on top of a society that is structurally unequal. And so, you know, the folks who are able to benefit from those particular models are not low to moderate income people, right, due to credit score and due to, you know, even access to banks, which we know redlining has made difficult in certain communities.
And all of them involve either going into debt or having, you know, large nest egg to invest into it.
Exactly. And so what I would say is that everyone pays their electricity bill, right? And studies have shown that this is one of the first bills that people pay, even when they're at the margins. We should use the electricity bill as a vehicle, as a mechanism to allow for on-bill financing of solar, which would mean, you know, the utility is essentially carrying that risk. And we could back up that risk. I mean, now I'm getting back into my corporate law, kind of corporate finance days, but we could sort of that provide a backstop to that risk with things like green banks, which are, you know, sometimes formed by a legislature, sometimes formed by other capital investments, but you know, there are ways to manage that risk. But we know that electricity and energy are fundamental human rights.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Shalonda, good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. My guest has been Shalonda Baker, professor at the Northeastern School of Law. Before joining Northeastern's faculty, she spent 3 years as an associate professor of law at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii, where she was a founding director of the Energy Justice Program. In 2016, she won a Fulbright Award and spent a year in Mexico exploring energy reform, climate change, and indigenous rights. We've been talking about her new book, Revolutionary Power, An Activist's Guide to the Energy Transition. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at Rising Up with Sonali. Sonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on Twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor